I thought we'd play a little game this morning. If it gets any traction, we'll keep it up. We'll do it every week. So the game this morning is let's count Steve's sins. All right. Now we're going to limit this to like an hour in my life because otherwise we kind of run out of time. But let's count Steve's sins. So let me give a little bit of background, identify the hour that I want to talk about. So last week, for those of you who are here, I talked about the untamable tongue. And I gave you guys James's wisdom on the tongue and how important it is that we keep track of what we're saying, what that reveals about our heart. And not only did I talk about the tongue last week, but how many times do you think I've warned you guys about the dangers of spending too much time in the news, being imprudent about how we communicate on social media, that sort of thing? I talked about that a lot. All right, so with all that as a background, so I left here Tuesday morning thinking, that was solid. That was pretty good. That's a pretty good lesson, Steve. Good job. All right, let's go. So now we'll start counting my sins. So I get to the office, and the first thing I do, I pull up my computer, and I access my digital subscription to the New York Times. Now, some of you are saying, that's two? That's two sins, actually, Graham? All right, patting myself on the back and subscribing to the New York Times, so we've got two sins there. Some of you might say, sin number three, I read an editorial by Paul Krugman. I hate Paul Krugman. I hate him with the white hot passion. He's almost someone that I read in order to get angry. He had a particular comment, or he said, I won't get the words exactly right. I think he said, the only people who subscribe to economic conservatism are people who package it with racial hatred. What? So at first I was going to go to Facebook. So I might get a point off of my sin there because I didn't do that. But you know what I did do? I thought of one of my left-leaning friends, and he sort of became my representative of all that I hated about Paul Krugman, even though this is a perfectly nice guy. We've lived a lot of life together. We've raised our kids together. He's a brother in Christ, but he's left of me, so I'm going to go after that guy. So I lift that quote, I put it in an email, I said, you remember when you asked me why I hated Paul Krugman so much? This is why I hate him, and I sort of make him the representative of it. So I don't know, where are we at, seven sins? Right after I had gotten done talking about the tongue. Well, what do you think I did with that relationship in that moment? I really did some damage to it. Not long term, hopefully, but I've been working since then to sort of patch that back up. I'm getting together with this friend on Friday, hopefully, if he doesn't back out on me. After I talked about all the dangers of the tongue, after so many times I've talked about the dangers of allowing sort of the news of the day to fuel our upset, our anger. Well, just to show you how much I learned from all that, last night as I'm going to bed, I'm just really agitated. I'm just tossing and turning. My wife's like, what is wrong with you? I was just reading this editorial from the Washington Post right before I go to bed. And this guy was calling for the resignation of Mike Pence because he is an irredeemable bigot. And someone like him who believes what he does about homosexuality, it is immoral and he has no right to serve in public office. How can this guy talk about what's immoral at all? He has no standard. These things change with the times. I'm not saying that I'm wrong about that, but I read that before I went to bed and I'm lying there and I'm telling my wife about it. And she said, hey, what's your nugget tomorrow? I don't know. She says, I've got one for you. I think it's wise for a godly man to go on a media fast for at least 1 week every now and then to just detox. So I'm kind of I'll start 1 hour after I get back to the office. So I'm paying my nugget forward. And I'm also giving you that story to say, I'm giving you all this stuff. I never want to appear as if I'm the guy who's got this all square rooted. I come to the book of James, and I learned from it. Hopefully my conduct changed from it, but to suggest that I have square-rooted it, that I've got it mastered, that I'm going to do it right, that any of us do, just not true. It's not true. There's so much of my flesh that remains to be sanctified. I never would have described myself previously as an angry person, but I've had to accept the fact that I just carry this level of anger. I'm like the Incredible Hulk. Remember, they said, "What's your secret? What's your secret? How do you just become the Hulk whenever you want to?" He's like, "I stay angry all the time." And I don't want to believe that about myself, but I have this anger all the time. Just whatever it is, the news of the day, the behavior of people around me, I can just stay angry. That's not how I should be. That's not how God wants me to be. That's not what we're called to. That's not what James calls us to. So I'm not trying to stand up here to say, so go forth and sin, because I do it. That's not the point. The point is that we all sin. We all need each other. We all need a wise word like I got from my wife last night to recalibrate at times. So this morning, we're going to talk about a related concept. We're going to talk about wisdom. And my talk on wisdom is going to be split into two parts. And this first part is titled, "The Wrong Kind of Wisdom." Next week, we'll talk about the right kind of wisdom for those of you who want to come back. I encourage you to do that to get the whole picture, because today we're going to talk about the wrong kind of wisdom, because that's where it appears in the text. And I wanted to start with a story from my younger life, not last week, but about 24 years ago. Early in my legal career, I was really scrambling to survive. A lot of you guys might remember my story. So I graduated from Emory Law School and stepped off of that stage with diploma in hand and right into unemployment with significant debt. Started my own law firm, actually, which is very unusual. And I was struggling to pay my office rent. I was struggling to pay my phone bill. Interestingly, I was not struggling to pay for my internet because we didn't have it. some of you younger guys might find interesting to believe. But anyway, I was getting any sort of client that I could get. Most of what I could get was I did some state-appointed criminal defense work, some personal injury clients. To this day, my wife says, I enjoy the stability of what you're doing now, but back then your stories were so much better. Well, I aspired to a career marked with integrity. At least it gave lip service to that, but I was becoming progressively disillusioned in a profession that really seemed to reward hubris and anger. That's what it looked like to me as a young lawyer. And even though I had my own firm, I had mentors through small firm bar associations and that sort of thing, and there were some of those guys, and I wouldn't even say most of those guys, but some of those guys who modeled to me a certain type of aggressive behavior, skirting the ethical edges. They kind of coached me in how to fight dirty. I looked at their cars. I looked at their clothes. I looked at their lifestyle, and I was like, I kind of want that. And a light went on in my head. I wanted what they had, so I determined to mimic that behavior. Like, I'm going to be like that. So that was my epiphany of worldly wisdom, the wrong kind of wisdom. I saw this behavior, I saw the fruit that I thought that I wanted, because I wanted a nice car, I wanted to make some money, I wanted to get out of my debt. So I had a new client come in as a personal injury case. I sent a really unreasonably aggressive demand to an insurance company. When I reached the insurance adjuster by the phone, I swore at him, pounded my desk, and I can't stand up here and say, before I was a Christian, I was a Christian. I was a believer. I'd been walking with God most of my life. That very morning, I'd had my devotional. I had prayed, but I wanted the money. I actually pounded on my desk loud enough that he could hear it on the phone, and I wanted to cow that man into a favorable settlement. I wasn't advocating for my client. I was advocating for my third contingency fee. I wanted to win big. And we'll come back to that story in a bit. But we'll read first from James chapter 3, verses 13 through 16. "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing." James starts this passage by asking, who among you is wise and understanding? I would bet that every man in this room would like to be considered wise. I can't think of a person on this earth who wouldn't want to be considered wise, and yet there is a scandalous lack of wisdom in our society. Despite our lack of it, wisdom has been a valued trait throughout history and across cultures. Look in the Old Testament. Pharaoh, the old Egyptian Pharaoh, consulted with wise men when he confronted Moses and his plagues. In the book of Esther, King Ahasuerus consulted his wise men when Queen Vashti rebelled against his command. The pagan king Nebuchadnezzar surrounded himself with the best and brightest men in his broad empire and sought their counsel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Daniel. Wise men from the east were among the first to recognize the arrival of the Messiah. And today, our highest-ranking politicians surround themselves with modern versions of wise men, the people who are supposed to be the best, the brightest, people who are savvy about the acquisition and leverage of power. And yet, today, I don't think anyone here argues that there's an abundance of wise decisions that come out of Washington. So how could something so esteemed, so valuable, and so available still be in so little supply? James speaks to that disconnect in this passage. Wisdom is in short supply because we use that word, wisdom, without really appreciating what it is, what it means. We pursue the wrong kind of wisdom, and then we apply that wrong wisdom in the wrong kind of pursuits. James helps us to understand what wisdom is by first telling us what wisdom is not. Wisdom is shown by gentle, good deeds, he says in this passage. Wisdom is shown by gentle, good deeds. Wisdom is not the skill of controlling our environment for the accomplishment of our own selfish pursuits. I think that's what we often think of wisdom as being. It's this ability we have, this skill, this insight, so that we can control our environment to achieve greater comfort. Well, if James were presenting this message in person, talking like I am to you instead of in a letter, I picture him saying, all right, who here thinks themselves wise and understanding? Now, if you raised your hand, prove it. Show me. To say that you have wisdom or to think that you have understanding without the accompanying action is as hollow as saying that you have faith when your life bears absolutely no evidence of faith. James knows that his readers count themselves wise. And he's saying, baloney. It's the most polite word I'd give it. But he has seen them compromise their beliefs in the face of trials. He's witnessed their anger. He's heard of their wickedness. He's seen them spout the law and not live by it. He's watched them treat one another with partiality. He's observed their relentless pursuit of money. He's heard about their adulteries and murders. He's observed their utter lack of mercy. He's endured their untamed and hypocritical speech. All those things that I just mentioned is conduct that he describes in this letter to these people. This was the behavior of professed Christians who thought themselves wise and understanding. James is challenging the recipients of this letter, and he's now challenging us. If you think you're wise, then show me. Show me good behavior. Show me deeds done in the gentleness of wisdom. Sophos is the Greek word that James uses here that we translate wisdom in English. The 1828 Webster's Dictionary captures this idea of sophos. And if you guys haven't been tuned on to this, you can just pull this up online. The 1828 Webster's Dictionary is a fascinating tool, even in the study of the Bible, because the words they use, what we would consider to be biblical definitions of a lot of words. It's really an excellent resource and free. But it defines sophos, or wisdom, as the right use or exercise of knowledge, the choice of laudable ends, and of the best means of accomplishing them. It is judging what is most proper, just, or useful. The right use or exercise of knowledge, the choice of laudable ends, and of the best means of accomplishing them. It is judging what is most proper, just, or useful. Wisdom has also been defined by other scholars as insight into the true nature of things. The wisdom of which James writes was not the wisdom of the Greeks, which was sort of an intellectual pursuit in an academy. It's, you know, when we think of Socrates, Plato, those kind of guys talking. It's not that kind of wisdom. The wisdom that James is talking about is encouraging is the ability to see things as God sees them, to view circumstances and people from God's perspective, and to act accordingly. And he talks about wisdom and understanding. The Greek word here translated understanding is really closer to our English word intelligence or knowledge. So the combination of wisdom and understanding is both powerful and rare. The wise man behaves, he doesn't just believe, the wise man behaves in the way that is good, the way that is edifying, the way that builds up, the way that is above reproach. The New American Standard Bible, the one that I use, says that the deeds of the wise man are done in the gentleness of wisdom. The NIV translates it, the humility that comes from wisdom. The wise man understands that God is the true source of wisdom. And the wise man knows where he stands relative to God, so he is humble. The Greek word translated gentleness or humility here means a mildness of disposition or gentleness of spirit. Other passages in the Bible translate that word as meekness. I won't ask you to show your hands, but I imagine not many would anyway. Who here really aspires to be meek? Who wants the world to say, that guy, what do you think of him? He's really meek. You know, most of us are like, I don't really want that. I can't even believe that's in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the meek. I don't want to be meek. But most of us don't aspire to be meek because we misunderstand the word. We think that it implies weakness or lack of conviction. But the Greek word translated meekness or gentleness is proutes, which describes power manifested in gentleness. Power manifested in gentleness. There's an interesting use of that word in other classical Greek sources. So other kind of contemporary Greek writings use this word to describe a war horse that has been brought under control and trained to take a bridle, imperturbably taking commands in the midst of battle. So meekness is strength under control. It is a useful and purposeful strength directed by a master. A wise person is not an independent person powerfully wielding their own influence to fulfill their own ambitions. The wise person is submitted to and directed by God. The fact that wisdom is shown by gentle good deeds causes me to ask, can I scream wisdom into my children? I've tried. Is it effective to try to impose our wisdom on a non-compliant child in a way that's not gentle? And is the alternative to ungentle behavior either silence or capitulation? This has been a challenge for me as a parent, but this image of the yielded horse is useful because I picture tremendous strength under control. Not a dad whose anger just gets unchained. I see a strength so apparent that it doesn't need to declare itself. A strength that prompts a healthy fear, but also a degree of comfort and protection. The voice of a wise father is both resolute and gentle, flowing from a confidence in God rather than a fearful effort to gain control. And I'll tell you that a lot of times as a father, what I'm driven by is a fearful effort to gain control rather than confidence in the God who loves my children more than I do. The but at the beginning of verse 14 is a warning to people who think themselves wise, but they're not exhibiting good deeds done in gentleness. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. In other words, if jealousy is your predominant emotion and selfish ambition is your ruling motivation, stop lying to yourself and to other people by claiming to be wise, because you're not. Stop being arrogant by claiming to be something that you aren't. Arrogant people think they have wisdom because they have a false idea of wisdom. That wisdom is not from above. It is not from God. And in fact, James uses strong words here. It is earthly, natural, and demonic. Now, the wisdom to which James calls us is not the practical wisdom that answers this question. Should I sell my Apple stock now? Or, you know, wait another month. If that was the way that godly wisdom worked, then Christian stockbrokers would rule the world. This is the great mistake we often make when we seek wisdom from God. We think of wisdom as special knowledge from God that allows us to increase our comfort. Okay, if I seek God's wisdom, then I'm going to make all the decisions that make my life more comfortable and pleasant and prosperous. And we think that that's wisdom. But wisdom that is from God conforms us to the image of Christ, and it has nothing to do with obtaining the objects of our jealousy or our selfish ambitions. In the work world, we observe skills of deceit, manipulation, and intimidation that often seem to win the day. Because that wisdom has apparent benefit, we might be tempted to imitate it, like I was saying in my story earlier. That conduct springs from jealousy and selfish ambition. It does not spring from godly wisdom. A lot of business books teach the wrong kind of wisdom. A lot of good Christian men read a lot of these business books and imitate that behavior. There's this sort of weird bifurcation people have. It's like, well, that's, you know, this is my spiritual life and this is my business life. It's kind of like in the Godfather. It's not business. It's not personal. It's business. You know, it's like we can have that separation. Too many Christians gobble up those books. They exhibit the same conduct in the workplace of other people, and they're indistinguishable from non-believers in the way that they work. That wisdom is earthly, it's natural, it's even demonic. The wrong kind of wisdom may appear to bear fruit, but it's the wrong kind of harvest. It's not the fruit you want. The fruit is disorder and every evil thing, James says. And we see that, don't we? We see a lot of guys who might be successful in the sense that they ascend in your organization, they make a lot of money, they have a big house, but you look under the hood and there's disorder in every evil thing. Earthly wisdom manipulates, it intimidates, it deceives, it exerts power in an effort to obtain materialistic or ego-driven aims. The wrong sort of wisdom produces a disordered life full of misplaced priorities, broken relationships, money that goes as easily as it comes, substance abuse to anesthetize the consequent pain, and it produces disciples who imitate the same behavior. Earthly wisdom is excellent at convincing us that we're doing better than we really are, at parting a fool from his money, at evading the law, at seducing a woman, cowing a subordinate into frightened submission. But those are all evil fruits born from the wrong kind of wisdom. James calls us to godly wisdom, evidenced by a well-ordered life under God, characterized by goodness and carried out in humility. Back to my story. So the insurance adjuster was an older guy. He was appalled, and he chastised me for my arrogant behavior, almost like he was my dad on the phone, and I immediately backed down. I was embarrassed. Stephen Hasner is like, what a moron. He's like, I can't believe Steve's even telling that story, much less that he actually did that thing. My effort at winning by intimidation was comically ineffective. I came off like, you know, a kid who's trying to pretend like he's going to work and he puts on his dad's suit. I mean, that's kind of how I came off in that conversation. It did not become me. I retreated. I returned another day armed with preparation rather than attitude, motivated by advocacy for my client instead of selfish ambition. I negotiated a fair settlement, and I stored that memory. There's nothing wrong with being excellent in our work. There's nothing wrong with doing well. There's nothing wrong with ascending. There's nothing wrong with making money. But what is our driver? What are our motivations? What wisdom is our fuel? What fruit are we bearing? For over 20 years now, I've been a transactional lawyer. I got out of the whole criminal defense and personal injury thing, and I've been primarily working in real estate. And in negotiating contracts, structuring joint ventures, closing deals, it can still seem sometimes like hubris and anger are rewarded and win the day. I'm still tempted sometimes to adopt worldly wisdom. To employ godly wisdom requires faith in the God who gives it. Because a lot of times it's counterintuitive. To employ godly wisdom requires faith in the God who gives it because it runs counter to the strident voices of worldly wisdom. Those voices are always going to be louder. There are always going to be more examples of those. All right? We're on the smaller road. Remember that? The small gate. How many times have I had to remind myself of that? I'm like, am I all alone here? Am I the only guy doing this stuff? Am I the only... Like, Steve, Jesus told you. Small gate. Narrow road. If I want to walk in godly wisdom, I have to marinate in the truths of God's word. Have to. That's where it comes from. Otherwise, the siren call of earthly wisdom is going to lure me into the rocks every time. Do you think yourself wise and understanding? then take an honest inventory of your life. What do you see? Do you see good deeds done in gentleness? Or do you see disorder in every evil thing? If you did an honest inventory, imagine that you saw some of both. Well, let's use that inventory to identify and repent where we're applying false wisdom and invite God to redeem those unsurrendered corners by filling us with his true wisdom that bears better fruit. You already got your nuggets.